It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Thanks for joining us on the WUKY Sports Page podcast. With the University of Kentucky football and basketball schedules beginning to overlap in October, what better time to talk to Oscar Combs, who has covered UK sports for more than 40 years. He was the founder and former publisher of the Cat's Paws, a publication dedicated to UK sports. He was a former co-host of the pregame show on the UK Sports Network. Also in his media background, a former publisher of the East Kentucky Voice and former editor of the Hazard Herald. A long and distinguished career. Oscar, thanks so much for taking time to do this.
Appreciate it. My pleasure to be here with you, Keith.
Oscar, you're, of course, from Eastern Kentucky, and that's an area known for its intense interest in UK sports. It's easy to see how you came by that, but tell us a little bit about how you first became interested in UK sports when you were growing up in Eastern Kentucky.
Well, I guess I was probably 9, 10 years old. My dad was a big Adolph Rupp Bear Bryant fan, and I can remember the name Bear. And I was looking for animals, and he was talking about Kentucky football. Mm-hmm. And I can always remember him talking about Adolph. This side. First game I ever saw Kentucky play was in 1954 at the Coliseum. It was back in those days, it was a UKIT. Mm-hmm. And the first time I'd ever been to Memorial Coliseum was that same year, too, to the state high school tournament. And fell in love with it then. For most of my teenage years, I relied strictly on Claude Sullivan, Kaywood Ledford, depending on where I was at. Mm-hmm. You had the Standard Oil Network with Claude Sullivan up until, I think, 66, 67.
About that time, yeah, things began to evolve into one network.
And then you had Kaywood, who was on WHAS. And I went through the routine things that people out in the state and other states did. We would always have a little Zenith radio that we would take a coat hanger to and wire for a little extra juice. And if that didn't work, we'd get in the car and we'd go up to the tallest mountain in Perry County and sit there and listen to it.
Yeah.
And once we started getting good radio, most of the stations in Eastern Kentucky back then were daytime-only stations. Mm-hmm. So you had to rely on HES at night. And that's when it started.
Yeah, and you certainly weren't alone in listening to the Wildcats that way, because a lot of people would do whatever it took to get the signal in and follow Kentucky on radio. It was certainly the way to do it at that time.
Yeah, and a roundabout way, that was part of what led me to start the Cat's Paws and move to Lexington in 1976. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had sold my newspaper and Hazard on at the time in 75. To the outfit that I'd worked for before that. And so in 76, when Kentucky wasn't having a very good season at one point, I think they were 10-10.
10-10, right.
And they won their last six games of the season, came from behind in the final game ever played at Memorial College season, I should say regular season game.
Right.
And I ran into a guy named Ray Hornback. And Ray was a friend of mine. He was a PR guy in the PR department, and he sort of lobbied newspapers all over the state on behalf of UK. And he said, our alumni is going to have a flight up to New York next week for the NIT if we win today. And that's when Kentucky was down 8 or 10 points with a minute and a half go against Mississippi State. Mm-hmm. Roby was out for the season with an injury, and he won it, and he said, are you going? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, take your wife and do it. So I signed up with Jay Brumfield, the late Jay Brumfield.
Sure, yeah, directed the Alumni Association for many
years. And they didn't have a charter flight, but they had group seats on a TWA flight out of Cincinnati to New York. And he said, hey, we're going to go up. We'll go up Wednesday. I think the first game was like a Thursday, and then the second game was like a Saturday or Sunday. He said, we're not going to win any games. If we're lucky, we win the first one. So we're coming back Sunday evening, you know, after the Sunday game. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, we're for it. I'd like to be there longer than that. Well, we got up there where they won the first game. And then I got thinking on the Sunday, hey, if they win, I don't want to go back now.
Yeah.
Well, I told him, and he worked out a deal where I got my airline tickets changed, and we won, and we stayed. And so the third game we're playing, they had group tickets, and we had our two seats behind Dr. Singletary and Dr. Hornbang. And so the third game, there's nobody there but us, me and my wife, except these three gentlemen that's sitting next to my left there. And I thought they were with the group. And I asked them, started talking to them, and they weren't from here. I don't know how they got their tickets. You know, maybe somebody, you know, scalped them or whatever. But anyway, they were three Kentucky fans. And this one guy was from Philadelphia. One was from Boston, and one was from there in Manhattan. And they all worked in Manhattan. Had their ties and coats on and everything, and as though they had just left the office. And got to talk to them about how they become Kentucky basketball fans. And they said, well, we've been following them since the 40s. And these guys weren't real old, but I'd say they're probably in their 50s. And I said, where are y'all from? You from Kentucky? No, no. And they told me where they're from. I said, well, who you know from Kentucky? We don't know anybody from Kentucky. And I said, well, that's sort of strange to me. He said, hey, we listen to Kaywood Ledford on WHAS in Louisville all those years. And I was already thinking about what I was going to do in my next chapter in my life. I'm 32 years old and retired. And I thought, you know, if I can run into three guys in Madison Square Garden who's never been to Kentucky before in their life, and they're fans, I think I've got some customers I could sell a sports magazine to. And when I flew back from New York, I met with Cliff Hagan, then I met with Joe and Fran Kersey. That was the birth of the Cat's Paws.
Yeah, and it became quite a story. And, of course, at that time, that was still a fairly new idea, a publication oriented toward a particular fan base. I mean, other schools, there might have been a few doing, but not
many.
No,
we were the first.
You were the first, yeah.
And ironically, Mississippi State was the second.
Yeah. So you're capitalizing on the intense interest that you found, and certainly it proved to be a tremendous success story. And I do want to come back to that era, but I wanted to ask you, too, you mentioned about working in the newspaper business in Eastern Kentucky and the Hazard Herald, the East Kentucky Voice, and the a small-town newspaper editor, publisher. Small towns, it's not really an exaggeration to say everybody knows everybody, and certainly the editor of the newspaper knows just about everybody. It has to, and everybody knows him. That can be good and bad, and I would imagine you ran into your share of controversies as well as stories that were very positive over the years.
You can be the most despicable person in town or the most popular person in town. I give this advice to hometown newspapers, particularly weeklies. You're much better off if you're neither Republican or Democrat. In any controversial story that you work on, there's two sides to it. Often there's three. There's this one and this one, and then one somewhere in between.
Somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm.
I always managed in Hazard the years I was there, and I was very fortunate, that no matter who was on one side, the other side know that I would give them their due time. And to me today, if I was 25 years old and wanted to go into journalism right now, you see where the daily Metropolitan paper's at. I'd go into community journalism. I'd go back to a weekly newspaper. You look around the death of journalism today, more often than not, the little hometown weekly's still there. And that's because they sort of play in the middle of the road. And what's happened to the major dailies, politics has killed them all, whether they're Republican, Democrat, left, or right. You're tagged as one of the two. Let's not be...
Everybody. You have to be in one camp or the other, it seems, or
you're
labeled that way.
And it's the only business I know of where the owners tell the customers, you've got to buy us because you don't have any choice. Now, today, with social media and with computers, you don't have to have them anymore. And what's happened, if you happen to be in a town that's got a Republican paper and you're a Democrat, you say, I don't have to buy your, I'm not going to contribute my hard money to your cause, and vice versa. And that's what's happened to the major journalism today. And I don't care what anybody says, when you're known that, they say it doesn't leak over into the news department. You know, wink, wink.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's hard to stay that way or stay objective, but of course the journalist, that's the mission anyway.
That is the mission, but so often it's not there. Probably the most important news story, two most important news stories I covered in my 10 years out of school back in Hazard. The biggest one was in 1969-70 era when almost 40 miners were killed in a coal mine explosion in Leslie County.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was just the 50th anniversary a year and a half ago of Bobby Kennedy coming to Eastern Kentucky. And he had it was a photo op, let's mm-hmm. be honest. Which was 3 weeks before he announced he was running for president.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I've seen that photo of you and him. It's not a posed photo, but you just happen to be covering the story that day, and you are in the photo with him.
Yeah.
And that's the context, I guess, he was there for that visit.
Yes, he was. It was a photo op, and he was walking up Liberty Street in Hazard, which was an African-American community that had rebuilt some homes for the poor under the administration of his brother, John F. Kennedy, years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And they were walking up through it, and we were interviewing him as he went up that way.
That has to be a great moment for you because, I mean, you're the newsman. Now you're covering it. You're doing your job. But at the same time, to look back on it now and to have the photo, it's got to be a great memory.
Yeah, it was. And I guess I had 15 to 20 requests from various national media 2 years ago to sit down and do some sit-down interviews about Bobby Kennedy and that trip. And I turned them all down. And the reason I turned them down, each and every one, there was an agenda there.
Mm-hmm.
They knew what they wanted, and they wanted to have my voice on it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, with Eastern Kentucky, all that has tried to be done, going back to the Great Society of LBJ, it's all been tinged with politics, and the money never got to the right people.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern Kentucky folks need jobs. They don't need welfare. They need jobs. They need to pay somebody to come in and build a factory and let those people go to work. With the coal mining jobs now gone, there's nothing left of it. I mean, right now, Eastern Kentucky is nothing but a huge guinea pig. And right now, who's benefiting the most from it is University of Kentucky Health, because they've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 employees at the Hazard Hospital
mm-hmm.
that's run by UK. They're doing some great work, by the way. But they've got all kinds of these grants that focus on diabetes, health disease, alcohol, tobacco consumption. But they need jobs up there.
Mm-hmm. And the people that have continued to cover the news through the decades have all seen these issues evolve, just as you did in the 10 years that you were there as a professional news person as well.
Yeah, and of course, the 20 years I had growing up there.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, and you look at that and you wonder what's gone wrong. But it seems like when the port comes into the state, you know, it just gets thrown in with everything else. And I blame all the politicians. It's not just one party.
Mm. Well, let's go back to the founding of the Cat's Paws. You were talking about having some meetings, and you got mixed reactions, I guess you might say, from the coaches as you met with them about the starting of this publication that would be oriented toward UK fans and covering UK sports maybe in more detail than anybody had before.
Well, yeah, you know, I had a previous personal relationship with Fran Kersey because he had friends in Hazard and came up there quite a bit with the Gorman family. And so I knew, I thought I had an ally right there. So I knew Joe. I liked Joe, but I was guilty of being in that group of people in 71, 72 on whether or not Adolph Rupp should be forced to retire or not. Gosh, he was everybody's grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he's
yeah.
your second grandfather. You know, you don't tell Grandpa he's got to go. You just don't do that.
Not when he doesn't want to.
Not when he doesn't want to. And so after I make my mind up that night up in Madison Square Garden, I tell Donna, my wife, we went back to the hotel. I said, honey, this is what I'm going to do. And I said, I'm going to meet with Cliff Hagan, Fran Kersey, and Joe Hall. And if two of the three or all three say, hey, it's a good idea, we're going. If two of the three say, I don't know, then I'm not going to fight the majority. So I first meet with Cliff, and Cliff's really nice, good friend of mine now. But Cliff's always sort of played close to the vest.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't against it, but he wasn't overly for it. But, you know, well, let's see how it goes. And I went to Fran, and by now, this is 1976, and they're on probation. or getting ready to go on probation. And he said, hey, Oscar, I love this thing. He said, but now let me get one thing straight now. And I won't mention the names he mentioned of local writers that he didn't like, but they were there. And he said, now, you're going to let me or someone at my office read your stories before you print them, aren't you? And I said, no, friend, it doesn't work that way. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, listen, I'm not out to get you. Hey, if I make any money on this, it's because fans are happy and want to read about it. The fans are not going to be happy and want to read about it if you got a losing record. So my investment, much in winning as yours is on that. But no, I'm not going to let you read it. And he said, well. So he was grumbling. And I thought, well, here we go. We got one on the fence. We got one that's just a little flick, and he's off the fence. And here I got to go talk to Joe. And 2 years ago, I wrote a story about Joe and Ray Mears, the famous Tennessee coach.
Sure.
And they were both belly aching. And I just wrote a column that, you know, they ought to take a big white towel. And when they meet at midcourt before the game, they ought to let each one of them have half of it so they can have something to cry on the rest of the day. And so I'm getting ready to go and meet Joe, and I start thinking, uh-oh, what if he read that? What's he going to say? So I walked in, sat down with Joe, and he said, you know, sis, I've been meaning to ask you about something. And he just turns to his left and reaches down and pulls a drawer out and pulls out the copy of my paper.
Had it right there for you.
That's the guy out there. He said, did you actually write this about me? I mean, you know, what could I say? Yeah, I did. Well, what were you thinking? I said, well, I was just thinking, you know, that Coach Rupp should be able to do what he wants to do. Well, I'm not concerned about that. I understand it, but what are you talking about? Me should have half that white town crown and Ray Mears the other. I said, well, I made a mistake, Joe. I said, I should have said it was for Ray and for you to watch him.
Oh, okay.
And then I said, no, I'm guilty.
Yeah.
He said, listen, I think this is the greatest idea that's ever come down the pike. Anything I can do to help you, here's my number, and here's the number that nobody else has but a few people. So I was off and running then.
Yeah, that was the key right there. That was the key. You might say that was the swing vote, I guess.
Now, I like to tell both Fran and Joe that I was their good luck charm. I was the Buckeye for Kentucky, if you're an Ohio State fan. And because my first year here, they go to the Peach Bowl, and the second year, they go 10-1. My first year here, the team goes to Elite Eight, and if it's not for Dean Smith and his four corners, they probably win the title that year. And the second year, they win it. So I said, can't get much better luck than that.
You did get off to a great start. And really, looking back on it, how important was that to the immediate success of the Catspaws that they had some great teams in football and basketball at that time?
Well, I mean, Kentucky fandom, there's none like it. Now, it's changed over the years. You've got a different Kentucky fan out there today, particularly the 40 and under. I get a little bit disappointed in some of our younger fans because they don't know the history. They don't know what brought it. It's sort of like a union. You know, young people in a union don't understand what people in the union 30 years ago laid the groundwork for them. I'm not saying I'm necessarily pro-union or anti-union, but anytime we're sitting in a studio right now, that wouldn't be this nice if there hadn't been some barriers broken 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so when you come back to that point, you gotta realize that you take a person like Ralph Beard, the Fabulous Five. We could go out in the community right now, and we could interview the first 100 people we see under 35 years old. But over 21. I doubt that out of 100, I doubt that three people could tell you who Cliff Barker is. And the three that we find that could tell you probably couldn't tell you that before he bounced his first basketball at Kentucky, he was in World War II. He was a fighter pilot. He was shot down over Germany and spent 13 months in a prison war camp and learned to pass the basketball because he had nothing else to do in the prisoner camp except to pass a medicine ball. So we didn't know the history of it. But it was important to get off that early start, which they were able to do. It wasn't always easy, but I had a little bit of marketing in my background. And anytime we would go play on the road somewhere, I would take 500 copies of the Cat's Paws, and I would go around to all the hotels in the region where I know we went to Waco once, and I took 500 there. That was the second year when they went 10-1. That was their only loss.
Right. Sure,
and I knew there were a lot of Kentucky people in Texas who had transferred from IBM here to IBM down in Texas. So I'd drop off 25, 30 at each hotel and leave them in the lobby free.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, we'd get one in, and then I guess it was 4 or 5 years later, I get a call from a subscriber in Los Angeles. They're getting ready to have a Kentucky Derby party. They have every year. 1,000 people there. Anybody in Southern California, Kentucky, come to the Derby. So, hey, I get this. Would you send me a few copies that we could lay out in the convention area? I sent them 500. We got back almost 300 subscribers over the next 4 months from that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, some great marketing early and good fortune on the field as well. So all of it working together, of course. One of the highlights I thought of the Cat's Paws, your columns, which covered any number of items. You might have a paragraph on one thing and then three or four paragraphs on another. But I know that had to be a lot of work week to week putting those together. But how did you approach that? And you have to develop your sources, of course, to get that information and confirm it. But how did you go about that?
You know, I learned that in Hazard. Up there, basketball is a huge thing. Football at that time wasn't so much because it was hard for rural schools to have football teams because they lived so far away and they couldn't transport them to and from practice after school. Basketball's a big thing, always has been. And so in the Hazard paper, I covered every team in the region. So I'd have a coach in every little school. And you know coaches in high school, they love the publicity.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Fraley from Powell County, who's now back up there coaching in. Gosh, he might be near me. He might be 70 now. But he'd send me stuff, and I'd use it. Larry Stamper, I covered him. I mean, that was 50 miles away in Lee County from
right.
Hazard. And so they all wanted it. And so I just developed source, and I said, hey, give me something nobody knows anything about. Somebody slipped me that. And so it's sort of a hodgepodge of little tidbits more than just one whole column.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out right then and there, in those days with hot type, letterpress printing, you would make it boldface, the name.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Elkins was in boldface. So you're reading a thing, and there's about 30 names in a whole page. It's boldface. You sort of just instinctively scan those names. And it's a name, you know, like Dale Brown. Oh, I'm going to read that part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or Ray Mears or whatever.
Yeah.
And that sort of caught on. That was very popular the way I did it in Hazard. And when I came here, the first thing I did is I put every head coach in the SEC, both football and basketball, on my comp mailing list. That was my best stroke of PR marketing I ever did. Almost immediately, I become on a first-name basis with Dale Brown and Ray Mears, and I never met them. I'd get a phone call in the middle of the night. When Ray Mears subscribed the first year, and rest his soul, his last 2 or 3 years, he had some health issues, mental health. And I got a letter from him one day. Not a letter. It was an order for the Cat's Paws. And there was a check in there. There were two checks. One check was from the University of Tennessee. And it was for subscription for Ray Mears, University of Tennessee basketball office, Knoxville, Tennessee. There was another for Ray Mears, 312 East Elm Street, Knoxville, Tennessee, his home. And he was in a medical facility in Johnson City, Tennessee, mental health, for about 3 months. And there was one for that.
Mm.
And when he retired, and I can't remember exactly what year this was, but from that day until the day he died, I got a Christmas card from him every year with a personal note.
How about that? Yeah.
And with Dale Brown, it was almost the same. And that, it's, these may be the most two hated rival coaches ever in the SEC for Kentucky fans.
Mm-hmm.
But I always, when I first started out, I would work through the SIDs. I put them on the mailing list. And I would go down and do a feature on each coach at least once a year, generally when they would come to Rupp or come to Commonwealth or on the road. And Dale Brown and Hugh Durham said, hey, you can have all day for me, because being in a Kentucky publication means there's recruits going to see my name. And that's the way I developed those sources. And Sonny Smith, I mean, gosh, the legends that were in the SEC at that time. And I do is pick up a phone.
Yeah.
Probably one of my better stories is when Kentucky was recruiting Jim Rose when I was still in Hazard, which would have been 68-ish there. And he had signed a conference letter of intent early with Houston. And the Southwest Conference, is what it was at the time, did not honor the SEC letter of intent and vice versa. So all that did was it precluded that Jimmy couldn't go anywhere else in the Southwest Conference or the one that recognized that. So Kentucky was recruiting him, and our late Willie Daher of the Daher Flan had told Coach Up, don't you worry, when it comes time, Jimmy Rose going to be at University of Kentucky. So the night before this happens, I get a phone call from a local Western booster there, said, hey, be at the TV station. That was the local cable station by Bill Gorman and Hazard. At 8 o'clock in the morning, we're going to sign Jim Rose. I said, who's we? He said, Western. I said, well, I thought he'd sign with Houston. Hey, that was just a conference letter. So I'm down there at 8 o'clock the next morning, and there, and Gene Rhodes was the assistant at that time at Western to Johnny Odom and signed him. So I go back to the office, and I pick up the phone, and I call Guy Lewis, University of Houston basketball coach. Now, you know how far I'd get today if I tried that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I call up, and this lady answered the phone, basketball. So I says, this is Oscar Combs with the Hazard Herald, and I was with the Herald at that time. I said, could I speak with Coach Lewis?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, could I tell you what it's about? Well, it's about Jimmy Rose. She said, hold on. Here he is. He said, hello. And I said, Coach, I said, I'd just like to get your reaction to Jimmy Rose, who just signed a national letter of intent with Western Kentucky University. He said, no, you got that wrong. He's with us here at Houston. I said, well, sir, I was just at a TV ceremony, and I just witnessed him signing the letter. No, there's got to be something wrong. And I said, well, you know, this one. He said, do you know a guy by the name of Gene? And I'll leave out the last name so we don't get sued. And he's no longer around either. Huh. And I said, yeah, of course I am. He said, you tell that SOB that $5,000 I gave him had better be back here tonight, or he's going to regret it for life.
Wow.
Click.
Wow.
Now, you know, how do you get a story like that
today? Yeah, how do you write that up? Yeah.
Now, later I found out what it was. He had paid this guy $5,000 under the disguise. This guy had a plane, and he flew Jimmy to Houston for his official visit.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now $5,000, pretty strong amount of money for 1968.
1968, you bet.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But all these things would come in, and you know, I just had a lot of contacts. The late Elmore Stevens, Scoop, mm-hmm. You remember him?
Oh, sure, yeah.
He took me. I went on the first Sky Riders, and I called him up and told him what I was wanting to do, and he said, son, first thing you need to do is get to meet all the SIDs in the conference. And the best way to do that is join the Sky Riders with us. And I thought, now, I wasn't thinking real straight. He had two spots to fill. That's what he was doing.
Okay.
He was filling two spots. But it was beautiful. And that's when I got to meet all these people. And they said, hey, here's a weekly newspaper. It's not even started publication. We're willing to invest in doing this. And basically all they were getting, I don't know if you went on one of them or not.
No.
But basically all they were getting was TV people. because they can make the money back on doing a special. You know, I think there were three writers on the whole thing. But I got in that and got to meet the people, and I won't go into another story, but it's what you put into it, developing relationships. And from that point on up through my last column, I think was in 2002, there wasn't a week that somebody in the SEC called, "Hey, Oscar, you probably don't know this. You know you didn't get it from me, but here's what happened last week." There, I'd write it down. I never had to worry because the people that would want to call and complain about it knew it was true.
Uh-huh.
You know, so they just left me alone.
Right, and whenever you've got them calling and saying you didn't hear it from me, then you know something good is about to follow.
The,
in most cases,
the Dale Brown story I got is he'd come up to Rupp Arena. Well, it was 78, and one of the two losses that year was to Dale Brown in LSU.
Mm-hmm.
And Kentucky went to overtime. All five of Dale Brown's starters fouled out. Kyle Macy missed a shot in overtime that could have won it. And you know how Joe B was after that game. Well, all during that year, Dale Brown is harping on Mike Phillips and Rick Roby. They brutalize the game. They're just two big goons, you know. So the very next year, they're up at Rupp playing, and they've got a couple of players, and I forget their names. I think it might have been Dwayne Scales, and there was one called the Cookie Man. So after the game, he's in a press conference. Billy Reed, who's a reporter at the time, was there. And so Dale was his normal self. And finally, Billy said something to this effect. "Dale, last year you talk about Roby and Phillips brutalizing the game. What about these two guys you got here? I mean, that." And Dale Brown looked at him and deadpanned. He says, "Have you ever masturbated?" Now, this is in a press conference. And, of course, Billy's taken aback. And he said, whoa, what's that got to do with it? He said, "I'm asking you, have you ever masturbated?" And he asked him a third time. And then finally things change. Well, about 3 hours later that night, I get a phone call in the middle of the night. It's 1:31. That's when the SEC played Saturday, Monday swings.
Yep.
They were playing Kentucky on Saturday, and they were going to Nashville to play Vandy on Monday. The president found out about it and made him call up every reporter that he knew that was in that press conference that night and apologize to him. So later, it's 10 seconds, and that's it. The next week, I'm writing a story and writing about it, and I'm talking about the hypocrisy that he made the two. So the very next Friday night, I'm at home at 1:30 in the morning, and the phone rings. He said, "Is this Oscar Combs that works for the Catch Paws?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "What do you got against me?" And I said, "Sir." And he said, "This is Dale Brown, coach at LSU." And I said, "Yeah, and I'm the bunny hop, too." I thought it's some crank call.
Sure, yeah.
And he said again, I thought, "Oh, my goodness, this is Dale Brown." And he's got the real good team that year. And it's 1:45, 2 o'clock, Saturday morning, and he's getting ready to play Georgia in a game that could win the league at noon that day, and he's talking to me. And he goes on and on about, "I know you got to be Big Blue. I know you got to do this. You got to do that. But you don't have to hate on me. You don't have to hate on LSU." We sat there and talked eternity, like an hour. And finally I said, "Well, Coach, you know, you got to do what you got to do, and I got to do what I got to do." He said, "Oscar, you sound like a pretty good guy." He said, "You know what? Since next time I come to Lexington, I want you to have lunch with me." I said, "Okay, Coach." Next time I saw him was at the SEC tournament. I don't have a better friend today than Dale Brown.
Yeah.
And, that's a kind of a relationship, if you go more than halfway, that you develop. And I've got all my great friends here at UK, but I've got an equal number on the road in the SEC.
Yeah, a lot of coaches, it seems. I mean, these are very competitive people, but if they understand that you're trying to be professional and doing your job, and that's what you're doing as opposed to having a specific agenda against them, once they realize that, then some of them are like Dale Brown, can become much easier to deal with.
Well, in the 80s and the 70s and 80s in particular, I mean, you start out with Ray Mears, and you got Hugh Durham, you got Sonny Smith, you got CM, you got Wimp, you know, and you go over even at Mississippi State, you know, you had Richard Williams and you had our buddy Jim Hatfield that was here at UK for a while.
Yeah.
You had Dale down there. Florida was the one that, you know, bless his heart, Norm Sloan.
Norm Sloan. Mm-hmm.
He, I mean, that was vanilla. I mean, that's all you could say. Vanderbilt went through some of there, but most of those guys were so colorful. You know, I mean, it was a joy to go to the SEC tournaments when they started back in 79 to about 90. I mean, the press conferences were awesome.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that era because we've seen over the last few years a recent push again to improve SEC basketball, which, of course, in a big way has to do with who's doing the coaching at the spots around the league. And we've seen, I think, an upgrade in that over the last few years. But it's not like this is the first time that there have been good coaches around the SEC, because that was a tremendous era for coaches.
Yeah, in the 70s, particularly from about 77 to about 89 or 90. I loved Sonny Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Sonny Smith would always say, "Fellas, there's only two games on my schedule that count." Back then it was four games. There were four games on my schedule that count. The two Alabama games keeps him at that job. The two Kentucky games gets me a raise. The rest of them doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys had great athletes. I mean, you know, forget. I mean, Charles Barkley, Dominic Wilkins, Jackie Dorsey,
yeah.
Neil Walk. I mean, you can go on and on and on about those players. But the difference, I think, then and now, in a lot of those times, you only had 8 to 12 NBA teams. Now you got 30. You know, and it's brought them up. Now, what's happened here in the last 4 or 5 years, thanks to SEC television, or thanks to the money that comes from SEC television, they're able to pay coaches.
Mm-hmm.
They could. The coaches in the SEC didn't make squat as compared to the Big Ten, the Pac-12, the ACC, up until about 10, 12 years ago. Kentucky's did, but not the others.
We've talked a little bit about coaches and the relationships you had with them around the conference, but, of course, the guys you had to deal with most often were the guys that were here. There are several, of course, that you worked with in the two major sports, but anything in particular that pops to mind as far as how a relationship with a coach either developed or turned on a certain incident, anything that pops to mind right away?
I always had good relationship. Probably the one with Joe has been, other than that very first week of dealing with that one column I wrote. I remember once with Joe, and this would have been probably about 79 or 80. And back then, the media could travel with a team. You buy a seat on the plane for the season, write the university a check. I had one, 27 had one, and the Leader had one early, but the Herald didn't because they had to file after the game. But the Leader was the afternoon paper. There were 5 or 6 of us. And on this one particular flight, we were going to, I think, Mississippi State. We were flying into Columbus, Mississippi. And I start to get on. Joe says, "Sit up here with me." And I said, "Okay." And I knew something was in the wind then. And we sat down, and he always brought a stack of papers with him. Herald, Leader, Courier, maybe a Sports Illustrated, something. And we're sitting there, and we're up there for 20, 30 minutes. And I said, "Joe, what's on your mind?" He said, "Got cat's balls?" I said, "Yeah." I answered, "Why do you print these stupid letters?" We had a letter to the editor, basically.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, Coach, you know, you got to give the fans this, you know, piece to say and everything." He said, "But some of these are stupid." I said, "Yeah, I know they're stupid. You know they're stupid. Don't you think the other fans know they're stupid too?" And he said, "Yeah, but why do you run them?" I said, "Well, Joe, it's clear as this. They're my customers. They've got a right to say. That doesn't mean they're right. But when I print their letter, they respect me for printing it. They give me a lot more respect if I'm defending you on something than they would if I took their letter and ditched it." He thought about it for, seemed like 20 minutes, it's probably 45 seconds or 30 seconds. Oh, I hadn't thought about that. And he changed the subject, and that was it.
Yeah. Just a short conversation was all it took. Yeah.
I'm not so sure that some of the writers he didn't like, it would have ended that way, you know. But that was it. The other coaches, Eddie Sutton, I love the man to this day, had a terrible disease. One of the greatest, maybe the best X and O coach I've ever been around in any sport. Loved his popcorn. All he wanted was a bag of popcorn. But the tragedy he went through, and I've had others in my personal life, relatives, friends, that's had alcohol abuse. Until you've lived with it, you really don't understand it. Had he never been addicted to it, he would have gone down as one of the greatest coaches of all time. Broke my heart to see it end the way it did here. There's a longer story there that we don't have time for here. But he's a good man. Things went awry because, you know, his mind wasn't there to be in charge of it. I was happy to see him go back to Oklahoma State and have some success there. But, you know, it came back on him there too. Good man. Rick Pitino, don't think there's another coach in the country that could have done what he did at the time with what he had. I tweeted this out a couple of days ago. He isn't the best player that ever played here, but the most important recruit to ever sign with the University of Kentucky up to today was Jamal Mashburn. He come out of New York. He was good in high school. He was great in college. And he brought a personality, humble to this day. And he was so all-classy. And I don't think I've ever heard anybody say a negative word about him at any time. The way he presented himself on the floor, off the floor. And the thing that impressed me most, after 3 years, he left, went to NBA, and he left a check for $500,000 to the university. And that's in 1993. That's, what, a quarter century ago?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful.
It is, and he, as you say, was a great citizen as well as a great basketball player during his college years, and immediately expressed his gratitude in a very tangible way to the university, and really has been, to my knowledge anyway, a solid, very solid citizen since then through his pro career, his business interests, all of that.
And he still has a lot of business interest here in Lexington. Mm-hmm. We go from Rick to Tubby, another class gentleman. Really good coach. He wasn't the very best in recruiting against other coaches. I just don't think he wanted to get down in the mud and wrestle. But not a better citizen, not a better person. He's always said eventually he would come back here and live. I hope he does. He was perfect for the time. Had very lukewarm success since he's been here. But he's just a quality human being. Mm-hmm. And then we go from Tubby to Billy Clyde, who I think has issues. I think some of the issues were what Eddie had, but he had other issues too. I think he was in way over his head. I think he was running from something when he left A&M rather than running to something UK. Mm-hmm. And when he got here, I think he realized real quickly that, you know, maybe I'm not cut out for this big a fishbowl. He's had other issues at other places. Fortunately, he's had health problems corrected now. Hopefully he gets along good. And, of course, that brings us to Calipari, who, you know, wanted the job when Billy Clyde got it. Mm-hmm. He came in with a plan. He had known for years that he had a system, and he just happened to be at the right place at the right time, in as much as that it was the one and done there, and nobody had really peeled that apple to see what the seed was inside. And he peeled the apple and said, hey, this one and done will work, at least until others figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 or 6 years later, Coach K figured it out.
Right.
But
right.
Until then, it was his baby. But he also realized to get those kind of players, he had to be at a name school. And I'm not disparaging Memphis State any, but and he did a great job at Memphis State, but they weren't in the big conference. And they didn't have the notoriety of a Kentucky, North Carolina, Duke, Kansas, that type thing.
Sure.
But once he got here, then, you know, I don't know at Memphis he could call up ESPN and say, I want y'all to televise 2 hours of my pro day 2 days in a row or do this. And he can do that here. And then he's produced on top of it. I mean, what he did the first 6 years here is pretty phenomenal. He had 4 Final Fours the first 6 years and a title.
Right. Right.
And he's still in the mix every year, and he keeps getting the players. If he ever gets to the point where he can keep a couple one-and-dones for 2 years with one of them being really good, he got help to – I mean, if Hero would come back this year, I mean, that's a if you can't take back, because there's no way – if he'd been picked 29 or 30, I'd say, well, he should have come back. But when you're in the lottery, you got to go.
You got to go, yeah.
You got to go. Mm-hmm. But he's got it up here on the peak of it. He's got it to the point to where the university can charge outrageous prices for home games and still get them to come.
Yeah.
That speaks for itself.
Well, you run through the basketball coaches there, and, of course, you work closely with football coaches there as well, and the real variety of personalities there. In fact, one change from Kersey to Jerry Claiborne, certainly two different men who had maybe a different approach to people, and both very competitive football coaches who enjoyed some success here, and then on to Curry and Mummy and the others.
I started out with John Ray.
Mm-hmm.
We believe
that was the slogan. Yeah.
I believe. I mean, he's coming from Notre Dame. They had the greatest defense in the country.
Yeah.
I
felt like if you were looking in central casting, you needed somebody to be in a movie to play a football coach, John Ray would be the guy you'd
be
want.
Absolutely, yeah. The great guy. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. But he came in here. He didn't get Commonwealth Stadium built. That's his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
He actually had a year left, and he went to the board and said, hey, I need 2 years. Give me 2 years. That's all I ask for. They said, no, you got one. And he basically politely said, take it and put it where the sun don't shine, and walked out. And Kersey came in, thanks to John Y. Brown, the governor, who wasn't the governor at the time, though, brought him in. And Kersey did some heavy recruiting, and they got up to 75. We had all this off-the-field stuff with a former player charged with murder. Sonny Collins was a senior. I did a podcast with Sonny, and he talked about, boy, if I'd just been 1 year later, because can you imagine that 76 team with Sonny running
Collins,
the ball?
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been the Peach Bowl. It would have been much higher up. But then some unfortunate things happened, and everything Fran's last 3 years up through 81, I guess it was, got magnified. I mean, his players got out there in a snowball fight, and one of them had a tire bar that when you fix a tire in a car and hit somebody, and it just exploded on him. And they did miss the 77 bowl season because of that. And Singletary was very, very frustrated. He felt embarrassed in going to academic meetings around the country with other presidents. I mean, today that'd probably been a misdemeanor, but it wasn't. It was then. And so he went to the other extreme, where coaching and recruiting was secondary, but run the class operation. And Jerry was quite successful in the ACC, but a record in the ACC of 9-2 would probably be 6-5 in the SEC. Came here, did a tremendous job, had a lot of 6-win season, but 6-5 back then didn't get you in a bowl game. Today it will. 6-6 will get you in. Back then you'd have 7-4 better. And he finally got down to that last year. And I think, if memory serves me right, I think he went 6-5 both his last 2 years. And he was 6-3 going into the 2 games. And, of course, we know that the last one each year was a loss to Tennessee. And after that 89, and, you know. And by then, CM had come on board. And CM did selling snowballs to Eskimos on Bill Curry. Bill Curry theoretically was playing for the national championship one night, and the next morning he was head coach at University of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that could ever be topped. I mean, I thought, you know, God's blessed us. You know, he's left at Tuscaloosa and came to Lexington, literally. And I still don't know what went wrong with that. Maybe Kerry just had so much going for him at Alabama. And there is a vast difference in recruiting a kid to Alabama versus Kentucky in football.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And we found that out from the Kentucky kids that's gone to Alabama.
Sure.
And vice versa in basketball. But he came here and tried to do it the right way. And then the final thing was his last year, his last 2 years, probably his fatal mistake was hiring Elliot Uzlak. And Bill McCartney is where Elliot was the OC at, I think, Colorado, when Bill retired. And Curry called him up and said, I need an offensive coordinator. And he told me, he said, you got to let him be the boss now. You can't overrule him. And that was probably Curry's first mistake because he started trying to put a square peg in a round hole and he started trying to have Tim Couch run an option offense.
Yeah.
And that was a disaster from where to go.
Mm-hmm.
So out goes Curry as soon as he's got the six losses, which means he can't have a winning year. That's pretty much a key because Kentucky turned around 1-3 in a row that year when Tim Couch was a freshman. Brought in Hal Mumme, was totally out of the box. Mumme wasn't the first choice, and there's some stories behind the stories. The guy that was supposed to get the job at one point was Mike Godfrey, who was working for ESPN but had been at Kansas and at Pitt and got fired at Pitt for some things that the president didn't agree with him on. But something come out during the process of that to where they suddenly shifted away from Godfrey and hired him. Beyond Oxford State, it's interesting. I was watching the E90 just Sunday on Mike Leach. And Mike was Hal Mumme's first offensive coordinator here. And you know what he's went through at Texas Tech and very successful at Washington State. Now, Washington State, they're expected to be a top 10, 15 team this year. But Hal came here, and because he threw the ball, because he was a maverick, air raid, fans enjoyed him talking about going over on Shively Field and finding some sand and drawing up a play, we're going to run this. And then Couch put up big numbers. The problem was, he recruited so heavy on the offensive side, particularly among receivers, that there was no scholarships left to build the defense, and poor old Mike Majors just had to take the arrows. So as soon as Couch left, and then you had the scandal, the little mini scandal there, maybe I shouldn't use the word mini, but the Memphis deal, Dwayne Robertson and Leonard Burris and all them. And he was gone. Then Gaimo came
and
in.
Some academic issues, too, I think.
Yes.
One too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then Gaimo came in for 2 years, and he wasn't going to be long-term. There was some friction. Actually, Gaimo was going to be fired the last year that Hal was here, except Hal got fired first, and that's how he moved in. But Gaimo did the right thing. He took the new contract at Baylor for 5 years with a significant pay increase. And he would have never been Mitch Barnhart's hire because he was already here. I love Gaimo. I hope his health improves. He's struggling there, but he was a good guy. And then, of course, in comes Rich Brooks. And Rich was sort of a made-over Jerry Claiborne. Probably wasn't blocking tackling as much, but he was old school. He had a lot of same values and everything. And he put together a pretty good staff, and they were playing pretty good football. The problem that Rich had early on is he was running up against a very, very good Louisville team as one of his four non-conference games. SEC, you kind of win those four non-conference games. And that's when Petrino had it going early down there. And it was hard to recruit. But before, unless a kid went to Notre Dame or Michigan, they came to Kentucky. They didn't go to Louisville. Some of those Louisville kids started staying in Louisville. He finally got turned around in, I think it was 06.
06 was the
pivotal
year.
Had had four straight bows. Then he started getting fidgety because he was frustrated that the athletics wasn't doing anything to improve the facilities. And they didn't have the money because the big money doesn't come in until around 2014 or 15. And so they say, we're going to do this. They don't get it done. So finally he just said, hey, I'm going home. And I don't blame him because he plays around the golf or fishes every day.
He seems to be enjoying life very
he
much.
He enjoys it the way it should be. So he turned it over to Joker. Mistake was made there, and I don't know who made it. He should have never been made coaching waiting. Coaching waitings don't work. Because almost immediately, the current coach starts saying, is the younger guy undercut me? Because he wants him to imprint now. And the younger coaches say, hey, how long is it going to be? Joe had that with Adolph. Mm-hmm. You know, Adolph was supposedly going to retire 5 years earlier than what he did. Adolph never agreed to that. But some of the people to placate Joe, don't worry, we'll take care of it. And then it didn't happen. And you have that friction. I'm glad that Joe and Adolph made up fairly quickly to get over that. But back to Rich and then Joker come in, and to Mitch's credit, early in the third year, he knew it ain't working. And they flipped it out. Then, you know, Mark Stoops is not the first choice. I mean, I'm not sure. He may have been the third or fourth choice. But we do know that the guy who ultimately went to Tennessee had first told Kentucky he was coming. And you know where he's at today.
Oh, yeah.
But Mark come along and, you know, he had that two-win season. And I think his two the first year?
Just know they haven't taken a step back. So it was two the first year.
It was two and either two and then five and five and seven and seven and ten. Somewhere along that line. They never did take a step back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And each year, if you were positive, you would have said, hey, we're not taking a step back. But then from the naysayers say, yeah, but we didn't take a step forward. But now when you step back and look at it, you look, wow, that's impressive. And I'm afraid that we're at the point they are now. Anything over seven wins this year, eight, nine, or ten, and they're going to be there's always eight or ten big openings a year. Big boys may come running next year if they win eight or nine or ten. And I think they got a good shot at winning eight this year. Herb Street said yesterday the best bet in Vegas today is the over-under on Kentucky this year. And the over-under on Kentucky is 6.5 wins. Mm-hmm. He said it's a lock. You take over.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people are wanting to jump on that.
You know, look at that. And I mean, he's got a great staff. I know the fan. I mean, you know, they're high one day. They're low the next day on 80 grand. Mm-hmm. But no matter how good the coach is, he's got to have some athletes. And when you get athletes, then you can judge the coach. Mm-hmm. And I personally think they're looking at eight wins this year. Depending on how some other teams, it could be nine. But I expect a solid eight.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're in a different era of UK football, that's for sure. I wanted to ask you about your most recent project, which is this kind of work, doing a podcast. You recently wrapped that up after just over 100 episodes. It's a great study in history of UK sports and a great look into some of the great personalities that have come through the program, both in coaching and playing and even other roles as well. Tell me about that project, and I know you enjoyed it very much.
Well, it's the most enjoyable thing I've done in my adult life. As far as work, and I know this is a worn-out cliche, but it's been a labor of love. Mm-hmm. And to be able to go back and talk to the heroes that's no longer in the spotlight. Bill Ray Lickard, I'd heard his name. I knew him when he played in high school at Lafayette. I knew him when he played in the state tournament. I knew him when I seen him. He knew me. We'd speak to each other. He sat on about the fourth row in the end zone with his wife at the game. But that was extent. And then I bumped into him about 12 years ago having lunch one day. And then we started having lunch with a group of other guys, some of them former players and coaches, Joe B. Hall, Gail Rose and them, at a local church here that has a cafe for lunch. And he got to be my best friend. And he would tell stories. And the story he told about him and his wife getting married, I mean, it was just so hilarious. And I thought, you know, people need to hear these kind of stories. I mean, it's homespun. It's almost unbelievable. It's like I'm watching Andy Griffith and Aunt Bee. You know, it's too good to be true. And so we started. My very first one was Humsey Yesen, who's from the old country, whose immigrant parents came to New York. Somebody in New York told them if they wanted a good job, they had to come to Eastern Kentucky and work in the coal community. So his parents went to Harlan, Kentucky. Now, a family named Yesen in Harlan, Kentucky, in the 1920s, give me a break.
That's pretty rare.
You know, that's pretty rare.
I'd say unique, maybe.
And he went to school. He and his brother went to school with Wawa Jones. Mm-hmm. And they were recruited together at Kentucky. Well, he turns out being a manager, you know. But he was a manager for both Rupp and worked for football with Burr Brown. He's in his 90s now. He's sharper than you and I together. He was a perfect person to kick it off. I mean, that's as far back as you can get to an origin of Kentucky football and basketball. And the guy still really knows what he's talking about. And then it just took off from there. And Billy was my fourth or fifth one. And, boy, I just thought, wow. And like you said, we did 101 of them. The last one, we just sort of went over all the previous ones. But
when you say we, you and producer Bo Robinson.
Bo Robinson was my producer. And, man, he is – nothing. And there's not a bigger fan to the history of Kentucky football and basketball than Bo Robinson. And he's going to have a future. I was telling him a couple nights ago, I said, Bo, you need to think about podcasting. You're the guy that knows that some of these guys are still living. You can go do a Mickey Gibson, or you know, go back and do these type players, and you know enough about them to ask them the right questions. You don't have to have a list of 50 questions. You just need 10 or 12 subjects or incidents. Let them roll. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the ones, is that there's been a few I did where I thought, this guy would be pretty good, but, you know, he's not going to be a star. And he turns out to be a star. Dennis Emery was a star. Marty Moore was a star. The little fellow that I just fell in love because he's 5'2", 5'3", and they call him Baby Magic.
Yep, Leroy Bird.
Leroy Bird. And the story that he had about how he was recruited out to UNLV by Jerry Tarkanian. And his second year there, he's playing so well in the first scrimmage. He scores 27 points. And the assistant coach that was recruiting him out there and comes to him after the first scrimmage. Jerry has the players together, and he just rips them apart for hogging the ball, taking too many shots, showing other people up. And the assistant coach pulls him aside and says, Leroy, son, you need to transfer. You're not going to be given a good chance here. You're not going to get to play the way you should. You need to transfer. And he only came back here during the winter. Leonard Hamilton talked him into transferring to Somerset Community College so he could transfer back a semester later and play. But the context of you're not going to play here is that day in practice he scored the 27 points. He lit up. The player he lit up was Jerry Tarkanian's son.
Yep.
And
one of the unwritten rules.
Yeah, unwritten rules. And then I think, boy, well, I mean, I'm, you know, thinking I'm almost done with the podcast. And then I get him talking about what's he doing now in his family. And I don't know if you listen to that podcast or not.
I have not heard the one with Leroy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, he lays the big one on me. He said, well, times are tough, but we're getting better. You know, I lost my son 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm not sure really what, I mean, it just hit me. And I paused me, and he says, yeah, he says, we were going to church one Sunday, and he was in high school, and he was working part-time at a local Kroger's. And he said, we were having lunch on a Sunday with the family, and he said, Dad, I got to go home and change clothes. I go to work at 2 o'clock. And he says, I'll see y'all tonight. So they stay there and still eating, and about 30 minutes later, they start to drive home. And when they start driving home, they see an accident on the other lane here in Lexington. And they get about a mile past it, and Lever says, that's my son's car. And he was killed. And then he just poured out his heart about how that made him and his wife have more faith. It's the most unbelievable podcast I've ever done. Mm-hmm. And it was those type of things in those podcasts that would come out. Terry Mobley, his wife called a friend of mine and says he wants to do a podcast less than 10 days before he passed away. And he just shared things that basically was on his deathbed. And these podcasts, for historical sake, someday Terry's great-great-grandchild may want to, or Leroy Bird's great-great-grandchild. Again, I wish I could have done more of them. But, and then you have a lot of the excitement of the games and stuff. Melvin Turpin, Brett Burrup. I did a podcast with Roger Harden, terrific. Mm-hmm. Kenny Skywalker doesn't get any better than them. They were so good when Brett Burrup passed away last year. I thought, I need to have somebody to come in and talk about what he meant to that team, what Melvin Turpin meant to that team. And they came in, and it's, I mean, just to have you a box of Kleenexes handed.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my favorites was with Jerry Hale, who played on the Super Kittens team back in 71. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in southern Indiana, and Jerry Hale was a big basketball star at the time that I was growing up. And to hear him tell the stories of his high school career and then on at UK. And, of course, I was a student at the time that the Super Kittens were playing. So mm-hmm. I was one of those students that arrived at Memorial Coliseum early. And those who
– And sometimes left before the varsity started.
Well, sometimes we did, yeah. But you had to get there early if you wanted to see yeah. those freshmen play, because those that are too young to remember, of course, the freshmen were not eligible for the varsity at that time, and they had a super freshman team that was undefeated, and the crowd would get there early to see those freshmen play, and hearing Jerry's stories was great, but that was a highlight for me, too.
The being able to go back and let them talk about their childhood and their high school events. Mm-hmm. Cotton Nash, I had to work on him for a long time.
Yeah,
Cotton was one of my heroes. Mm-hmm. I mean, even today, I mean, you know, he was slick. He was like the 50s with that blonde hair.
Oh, yes.
They
yeah.
called him – I mean, do you know he never played basketball until he was 15 years old?
He was focusing on baseball at
baseball
that time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And his hero was Mickey Mantle. Mm-hmm. And he moves to New Albany, Indiana, and he starts playing basketball. That's why – and they call him Cotton because he's got gold hair, red hair, blonde hair,
yeah.
I should say. And did not know it until we did the podcast, and we're talking about – well, who's his coach in high school? And lo and behold, his high school coach, Mr. Barker,
Cliff Barker.
And then he goes to Louisiana and he talks about how the rules are sort of like chaotic, like some high school rules are. He couldn't play the first year when he moved to Texas because he hadn't been there a year. So his father moves him 40 miles over to Lake Charles, Louisiana, so he can play. And then the funniest thing he said in the whole thing was, well, two things. One thing was they were playing the Sugar Bowl tournament, getting ready to play Duke. And his parents had drove down from New Jersey, and they didn't have tickets. And so they get on the team bus to go to the arena, and he's not on there. And Rupp says, Harry, where's Cotton? Coach, he's, I guess, in the hotel. Well, go get him. Harry says, Coach, he said he ain't coming. Well, why isn't he coming? He said he didn't have any tickets for his family, and he was just going to stay in the hotel and watch the game with them. Well, Harry, take him these GD tickets.
Yeah.
And he took him the tickets. And then the other thing he talked about is, you know, he's a baseball player, played for the White Sox.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And he said his ultimate thrill is that they blew like a 5-game lead with 6 days to go in the league, but late in the season they went and played in Yankee Stadium. And said he came out in the dugout and said he started to take out, looked up and said, there was standing Mickey Mantle. I mean, you know, you can't beat that if you're a sports fan.
Oh, absolutely.
Or an athlete.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are just so many great stories. And while you have wrapped up the series, those are still available on your website, right?
Yeah, just go to oscarcombs.com mm-hmm. and click on the podcast list, and they're all there, all 101. You can scroll down. Some of them are one episode, some are two, some are three.
Yeah.
I think Joe B. even got four out of
I think he was a four-parter. Yeah, I'm working my way through them, and they're all just the players or the coaches, or the sports figures that you talk to. People sit down and get comfortable, and they start telling these stories, and it's just really it's radio gold, as they say, because audio gold, I guess you'd say in this case, because these stories are history as well as entertainment.
Yeah, I miss old radio. I can remember growing up and listening to Kaywood, I was driving one Saturday working for the newspaper in October. I was going to some festival, I want to say in Owsley County, which is about an hour's drive from Hazard. And I was switching stations. As soon as I go from one place, I'd have to switch over to another, like Hazard and Jackson, where I'm switching there, and Kentucky's at Auburn. I'll never forget this. And Kaywood comes on and says, from the loveliest village on the plains, here in Auburn, Alabama, Kentucky takes on the plainsmen of the Auburn Tigers. And the cats today will be moving from left to right on your radio dial. I mean, I can hear that just like it. And he opened just about every show with that left to right or right to left on your radio dial. And I mean, I don't know how I kept from wrecking, because I was looking, but my mind, my eyes was seeing what he was painting for me.
Sure.
On that period. People tailgating. And you know what? We've been cheated all that by TV. Now, I wouldn't trade the TV, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But, you know, the picture I was painting, maybe not was the picture he was painting, but that's what I was reading from his voice.
Sure.
And that's all that mattered.
Yeah, it's such a special relationship between radio and basketball, and, of course, in particular, I think baseball, that the great broadcasters have brought us through all these years. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned our friend Bo Robinson a while ago, and I know one interest that you and he share is memorabilia, souvenirs from all these great sporting events that you've been associated with or had an interest in. Tell me about your interest in that and where that stands now.
Well, I'm a pack rat. I've got far too much stuff that should have been thrown away years ago. But I've always keep my old media guides, game programs, all my press credentials, you know, things like that. I have Ralph Beard's freshman jersey, road jersey. It's wool, it's blue with white royal lettering. Kentucky across the front. No name on the back. The tag down the thing. Rick Pitino's first year here, I guess, was 89-90?
Yes, it was.
89-90. There was a charity outfit out of Louisville put on a charity breakfast to raise money for a foundation. And Rick had called or written some of the people in the NBA and former players here about auctioning things off for this charity. And they had the breakfast. It was downtown at one of the hotels. And they had all this stuff there. And Ralph came up to Rick and said, hey, I don't have anything that would be right. He said, but here's my freshman jersey. You know, put it in there. And so I was looking around and looking at it, and I thought, wow, Ralph Beard? All-American, Ralph Beard, Fab Five, Ralph Beard, national champion, Ralph Beard, Olympian. And is there? So they were auctioning all this stuff off. And the people there weren't really into memorabilia. So, I mean, they were, stuff was going for $20, $25, $20. And I see that, and I said, boy, that ain't going to go for no $25. Vernon Hatton, All-American, was the auctioneer. And he held it up, and it looked pretty rough. I mean, hey, it's from 1944-45. And he auctioned it up and told him what it was, and he said, let's start out with $25. And he went a good 4 or 5 minutes, and nobody would bid $25. And I'm thinking, man, I'm embarrassed. And I was there covering it for the customer. I wasn't in the bank. And when he said, well, somebody give me $10. And I don't know what. I just said, $250. No, no, I got to have 10. I can't. I said, $250. Oh, okay. And I bought it for them. And I went up to Ralph after it. And he said, you didn't have to do that. And I wanted to say, Ralph, it's an honor, and it would have been a disgrace for you to have seen that go for $25 or $50. I didn't say it to him. But that's my prized possession right there. I've got some game balls. I've got, you know, a lot of old. I did do this when I opened Rupp Arena, which was that first year. I bought two tickets. I've had two season tickets there every year. Most of that year, though, I would go up. I'd do my other work, and then I'd go up and sit with my wife in the seats with it. Mm-hmm. But since I had a press pass, I didn't tear up my tickets. So I've got an unused book of season tickets from the first year at Rupp Arena.
Yeah.
Unused.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but.
Well, it means a lot to you, and it's hard to part ways with things like that. I've got a bunch of old media guides and things like that around the house as well, and somehow you just can't let them go and toss them away, can you?
No, they have the memories there. I have a couple of score books from my days in Hazard, when I would keep score of the Kentucky games at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, I used to be ridiculous when I was in high school. I kept score every night. Sometimes I missed a play or two because somebody would have a foul on free throws, and I'd be putting two little circles for the free throws and forget to P2 on the foul.
Right.
You know. But I was into all of that.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about all of these great projects, and I know there must be something ahead right now. You're kind of between big projects, I guess, but what are you thinking about as far as staying active now?
You know, I don't really have anything planned. I've been wearing this boot for a while. I'm just sort of letting things take it easy. Mm-hmm. I don't lock any doors. I might close them a little bit, you know, a little bit close, but I don't lock them, so I can always go back into something, but I feel comfortable. I just want to enjoy things. I hope to be able to cross off a couple things on my bucket list. There's two or three places I'd like to visit. I'd like to go back. I haven't been to any of the SEC venues since 2002, other than Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And last time I've been there was 7 years ago, and I swore after that game I'd never go back in football. But there's some places. I'd like to go to Texas A&M. I'd like to see a football game there. I meant to go last year, so I don't know if I'll make it to the next night. You know, you only play about once every 20
right.
years.
Uh-huh.
My good fortune was on my bucket list I have crossed off. I've seen many games at Kansas. For the record, Joe Hall has the best winning record against Kansas and Allen Fields of any coach who ever lived, by the way. Most people don't expect to hear that. My first year here, when they went to the Elite Eight, my first NCAA tournament game as publisher of the Catspaws was in the Palestria.
A great tradition in Philadelphia, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, you know, there's a few venues I'd like to do that. When I came to Lexington, baseball sort of took a back seat, and there's a lot of play. I'd like to go to Fenway Park once. Mm-hmm. Wasn't there? I've been to all the cookie cutters, and I'll never forgive the higher ups for that. But I know they were doing it for football and baseball.
Right.
You know, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Atlanta, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. Who am I leaving out?
Those were the ones that I think of as that cluster of as you say, the cookie cutter stadiums, the round ones where you could get. Boy, there were a lot of terrible seats for baseball in those parks, and I hate to even call them parks because they were just stadiums and multi-purpose. You can see the thinking behind them, but I'm sure glad we got beyond that era with the new old ballparks that came in the
90s. In the 50s and 60s, I was a bigger Reds fan than I was a Kentucky fan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I came up on the early 50s, Ted Kluszewski, Johnny Temple, Don Blasingame, Freddie Hutchison, I thought was the greatest human being ever lived. And we would drive to Cincinnati is a 5.5 hour drive back then. There's no interstates. Mm-hmm. We started, and I can always remember my dad, we would park one of the side streets at Crosley Field. And as soon as you'd pull up to park on a street, there'd be four kids run up and say, "Well, what's your car for a dollar?" And my dad would give them a dollar. And we'd go to the game. I said, "What'd you do that for, Dad?" He said, "I don't want them on four concrete blocks when I get back."
That's right.
And that was just part of it.
Yeah.
And I think it was, I can't remember where it was, 54 or 56 that the Reds set the major league record for home runs, 220 some odd.
I believe that was 56, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Now,
Frank Robinson's rookie year, I think.
The trouble is the ERA for the pitching staff was about double that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how many. I love to go to Crosley Field. The first game of a series in batting practice and the fielding, and watch rookie outfielders try to play that terrace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they'd run up the top and hit their feet. Then they'd stay down here and they'd hit over their head.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the famous thing, you remember the what they called the right field bleachers?
They called it the sun deck in the daytime, and they'd flip the sign and call it the moon deck at
you
night.
You got it.
Yep,
you got
I was
it.
There.
Yeah. And now I go back to when they had the laundry beyond the left field fence. And any player that hit a home run and hit the laundry sign got their clothing free. I think the guy gave them a little bit more than that now.
Yeah, probably but have the, to make it a little
but
bit
the
more
old big Long Jeans scoreboard
sure.
was on top.
Yeah.
And in 1964, I was the year I got married, I came up with Willie Dollar had a minor league team, and he'd bring them up to a game. He had some kind of association with a clubhouse attendant. And a clubhouse for the Reds at that time was a building built on concrete blocks, literally underneath the third base stands. And you just walked around it, and they had a couple of pipes that went up, and that was it. And he could get us in there. And in 1964, I came in there, and he got them to let me go up and sit in a press box. So I got to sit in the press box at Crosley Field. In Wade Hoyt's seat for about 15 minutes, 2 hours before the game.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you something. There's never, well, I shouldn't say it because I wasn't at the probably where. I've never been in a press box or anything like that. It was a metal back. In the summertime, you'd lose 10 pounds. That heat would hit that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was, is you had to file in single. And when you got in, you didn't get out. And they had two breaks after the third and sixth innings. Everybody would get out to where you'd go to the restroom. And you were stuck mm-hmm. the rest of the time.
Yeah.
But those are fun times.
We could probably do another entire session on ballparks and that era. It's interesting, too. The Reds this year, of course, are celebrating the 150th anniversary, and they've done the throwback uniforms from several different eras. And that seems to have been amazingly successful, and they've really done that well. And recently they did the 61 team, which goes back to the era that you're talking about, the Pennington.
Yeah, and that's when I played high school baseball, and our school had those uniforms, the mm-hmm. sleeveless uniforms. And my hero back then, I played first base, and I loved Gordy Coleman.
Yeah.
I loved Klazuski, too, but Gordy, I mean, he was just such a jolly fellow. And I wore number 28 because I loved Veda Pinson.
Mm-hmm.
And those times were the Reds then. And then, you know, when they moved forward, each year we made two trips a year to see the Reds, and it was always a weekend series. And we'd leave early on a Friday morning. We get back midnight Sunday night. And Wade Hoyt, I didn't really enjoy his description of play-by-play, but, boy, I loved him during the rainouts.
Absolutely.
I mean, he was gold during rainouts.
Yeah, people bring the rain delay up almost as soon as they mention the name of Wade Hoyt. Oscar, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today and share these, having you share your memories and experiences with us. You're a treasure to UK sports and to sports fans all across Kentucky, and sure to appreciate the time today.
Been my pleasure, Keith. I've enjoyed it immensely, and who knows? We may have to do it again sometime.
Well, I would love to do that, and we can, like I said, we can do a whole session on those ballparks and visits to Crosley especially. Thanks again.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.